Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. Great to have you here this evening. My name is Peter Trubowitz. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department here and the director of the Fallon United States Center that is hosting tonight's roundtable on the risk of nuclear war. So we've been living with that risk for almost 80 years now. And worries about the risk of nuclear war have ebbed and flowed, but in the past few years, those worries have mounted, largely, I think, in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Putin's thinly veiled threats to use nuclear weapons, but also over other conflicts in the Middle East, the Taiwan Strait, and the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, Christopher Nolan's blockbuster Oppenheimer, documentaries like the BBC's Nuclear Armageddon, How Close Are We, have heightened public awareness of the dangers or the risks of nuclear war, as has the New York Times' The Brink, its recent series, kind of detailing how close U.S. officials thought the world came to nuclear war on multiple occasions. We wanted to take a closer look at this. The center wanted to take a closer look at these developments and to try to take stock of where things stand today. Is the risk of nuclear war truly greater? Is it increasing, as many fear? And if so, what are the main sources of that risk? Does it lie on the technological side, the political side, somewhere else? And what steps can be taken to mitigate it? And this is tonight's agenda. And to help us get, there's a few seats up here. To help us get a fix on the answers, we put together a panel of leading experts that are here at the LSE, either as faculty members at the LSE or visitors for the year or part of the year. And briefly, to my immediate left is Professor Jeffrey LeGros from the University of Richmond in the United States. Jeff is the author of Rethinking the World, Great Power Strategies and International Order. We've been very pleased to have Jeff this year in residence at the U.S. Center and in the International Relations Department. Sitting next to Jeff is Dr. Lauren Sukin. Lauren is an assistant professor in the Department of International Relations, an editorial fellow at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and a faculty affiliate at the U.S. Center as well. She has written extensively about nuclear weapons and their effects on world politics and especially on alliance relations. And her work has appeared in many leading international relations journals. And last but not least, rounding things out, is Dr. Fred Kaplan, who writes on defense matters for Slate Magazine, and is a New York Times best-selling author with six books to his credit, including most recently the highly praised The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. And we're very pleased to welcome Fred to the U.S. Center as well as a visiting fellow for the next 4 weeks. He just got off the boat, so to speak, today. So he's here, he's fresh as a daisy and ready to go. So welcome all of you. It's great to have you here this evening. Maybe just a few words about the game plan before we we get started. I've asked each of them to speak for about 5 to 7 minutes to summarize what they consider to be the greatest risk of nuclear war today and why. And once we go through, when the three of them have spoken, I'll probably put a few questions to them before we open it up to get all of you involved in the conversation as well. Before we get started, if I could just ask you, if you haven't already turned your phone to silent, please do that now. And please join me in welcoming the speakers. So, Jeff, we're going to start with you. You've been working on these issues since you were a PhD student, so just a few years ago. So when you look at it, addressing this question, I mean, where do you think the greatest risk is? Or, I mean, maybe even just to start, do you think the risk is greater today than, I don't know, let's say, in the early post-Cold War period, and maybe how does it compare to the Cold War itself?
Yeah, so before answering that, Peter, I just wanted to say thank you to you and the Phelan Center and all the Phelan staff and LSE more broadly for hosting me this year. It's been an incredible year.
Yeah, that's right.
I've learned a ton, and I'm just really nice to see this audience here tonight. Just a great place, so thank you. Let me start answering your question with a biographical note, which really is about a cold and rainy morning, literally a cold and rainy morning, November 4th, 1980, when I got up early as an exchange student in Moscow to go to the U.S. Embassy to look at the, find out what the results were and follow the election results of the U.S. presidential campaign between Carter and Reagan. Mm-hmm. And by the time we got at the embassy that morning, it was over. Reagan, of course, had just totally dominated the election. And I can still remember leaving that embassy and walking through the city, the streets of Moscow. It felt a little scary, and people, who can say whether it was the November weather, people were worried. They were hunkered down. There was an air of fear about it. And I have to say that that was the beginning of my deep interest in nuclear weapons and the possibility of nuclear war. And so when you look at what's going on today, it depends where the starting point is, if the risks are increasing, right? If you started in the mid-90s, they're definitely increasing. If you're looking at some of the heated moments of the Cold War, and that was one, because the risk of war was very palpable at that point, it's hard to say they're increasing over that. And I want to just answer the question specifically, what's the greatest risk today? But I'm going to come back to this notion of where the stability has come from and what generates it. But if I had to answer specifically, and there's lots of different scenarios out there, it would certainly be that the greatest risk today comes out of one of the geopolitical situations that are out there, one of the big ones, U.S., Ukraine, the Koreas, India, Pakistan, Taiwan, and obviously not immediate, but it's certainly in the background, is the Mideast and Israel, Iran. And the thing that makes those situations dangerous is a mix of two things. One is the level of existential threat, the threat that the people in that conflict feel to their nation, their immediate security, their homeland, is one thing. And that mixes with a second thing, which is organizational routines, how their militaries fight wars and the different systems they have to control how they fight wars and use nuclear weapons. And when you put those two together, those two things, the situation I think is most dangerous today is India-Pakistan, because this is a situation where both countries feel an existential threat from a conflict. and there are countries where the systems of control vary, is the way I would put it. But because they have a very active a boundary and land dispute that has fueled four wars, numerous skirmishes, that's a situation to me that is very troubling and that could easily ignite something that we don't want to see. Now, I should talk a little bit about why that maybe doesn't keep me up every night, because it could. And I would say the reason that is there is a basic stability to the system. It's a stability that's always being challenged, but the stability comes from mutual assured destruction, essentially. The notion that any leader who specifically launches a nuclear attack can be reasonably confident that some level of nuclear weapons will be fed back to them that they cannot stop. That is a sobering fact that has affected leaders' decisions, and there's good evidence out there that leaders, the more they're in office, whether they start from a used nuclear weapons point or a zero nuclear weapons point, end up in this mutual assured destruction box. States want to get out of it, but they can't. It's both a troubling problem, but it's also a source of stability and a brake on use. The second reason is because of what I would call the global nuclear order, which is this series of understandings about nuclear weapons as being unthinkable, that there's a taboo against their use, that there's a heavy price to be paid for those outside of the actual damage one might receive, and that there are a variety of understandings about checks and balances on nuclear use, about the appropriate mechanisms to set up to check their use, about arms control, about proliferation, and all of those provide a type of envelope that protects against unwanted escalation. And I can give a most recent example of that comes from the very situation that I said was most dangerous, which is India-Pakistan, because in 2022, India accidentally launched a missile. And in 3 minutes and 45 seconds, that missile had gone 124 kilometers into Pakistan's territory. That did not lead to a war. That did not lead to a conflict. There are, and I think what that speaks to is, it's hard to believe someone is launching an intentional nuclear attack. And that we have a series of episodes where people have checked because they find it hard to believe. So there is some guardrails. I think looking forward, the thing we need to be worried about is this thing that I call the global nuclear order shows signs of erosion. Our arms control agreements are falling apart. The level of communication and transparency about nuclear weapons is greatly diminished. For example, between Russia and the US, there's almost no dialogue going on anymore. There is one small scientific group that still has an exchange going on. The US and China are trying to get going talking, but not making a lot of progress to date. Obviously the Iran nuclear agreement fell apart. START agreement, INF have fallen apart. So these things that constitute this order that are bricks in the wall are showing cracks. And for me, that is a cause for concern and a cause for our attention, a need for our attention to this problem. And I'm delighted actually to see so many people out here today, because the level of concern and the level of attention is fundamental to fixing things. So to me, very encouraging to see this amount of current interest in the problem. Thanks, Peter.
Great. Thank you. Very good. Lauren, where do you come down on the question?
So, unfortunately, unlike Jeff, my PhD was in fact only a couple of years ago. And the difference there is that when I started working on nuclear weapons, people would ask me why. These are something that are obscure. They don't matter. And the context in which I started studying these was not a Cold War context. It was one in which the key problems of the world started to look like they were intrastate and not interstate conflict. They were not about the use of weapons of mass destruction. And today, when I tell people that I study nuclear weapons, they say, why? You have to think about this horrific thing all the time that looms over our heads. And that change, I think, is quite remarkable in just a couple of years. The number of people that we see in the room today, as Jeff said, is again an indication of renewed interest in this problem. And I think that renewed interest is due to real changes that we see in the geopolitical environment that have recentered nuclear weapons as a tool of statecraft. So I want to talk about three country-specific contexts in which I think we should be concerned about the use of nuclear weapons, and one broader problem for the international order that I think makes all of these concerns worse. So I want to start out by talking about the Russo-Ukrainian War. This is a war that has an explicitly nuclear dimension. Putin has repeatedly made nuclear threats, and these threats come from all levels of government, including from Putin himself, but also from other officials in the regime. And of course, nuclear states make threats. The United States, the UK repeat all the time that all options are on the table, but the character of the threats that we're seeing from Russia is different for a couple of reasons. One is that Russia's behavior here is expansionist. The threats that they're making are threats to protect activity that is not legal under international law, that includes the taking of sovereign territory. And this is a much more aggressive use of nuclear threats. It looks much more like nuclear compellence, demanding behavior from other states, than it does like nuclear deterrence, trying to shape or maintain an existing international order. That is, Russia is using its nuclear arsenal to change the footprint of the current international order. This is something that is new in at least the post-Cold War era and something we should be quite concerned about. Another reason why I think Russia's nuclear threats are different than the threats that were made during the Cold War and are particularly notable now is that Russian nuclear doctrine emphasizes the possibility to use nuclear weapons if Russia faces an existential threat. And traditionally, that's been interpreted as direct threats to Russian sovereignty or Russian territory. But at times, Putin and others in his regime have reinterpreted that doctrine to suggest that the existence of Russia itself becomes under question if Putin is no longer the leader. What we see there is part of a broader trend. We have personalist and increasingly nationalistic leaders in nuclear states, Russia included, that are confusing what should be a tool at best of maintaining states in their current form as a tool to maintain their own personal power. And this raises new opportunities and new challenges. If Putin were to consider the use of nuclear weapons, he is surrounded by yes men who would have a very difficult time challenging his interest in the use of nuclear weapons. Now, again, this is not just a problem for Russia. Nationalist, personalistic tendencies that we see in India are part of a problem. The United States president has the sole authority to use nuclear weapons. So as we start to think of new challenges in the world related to these trends, we might see a degradation of some of the checks and balances that have tried to keep nuclear use out of the control of leaders. So these strategic culture problems are significant. But one reason why we might be less concerned about nuclear use in the Russo-Ukrainian war is that it has also shown us that nuclear deterrence works, that there are clear limits to what Russia is able to do, that it's unable to expand its aggression onto the borders of NATO states, and that NATO has effectively used its nuclear deterrent to similarly draw red lines around Russia's possible behavior. This is not just about nuclear weapons, but about the increased integration between nuclear and conventional systems. We know, for example, that China has put pressure on Putin to refrain from additional aggression in the war, to refrain from nuclear use, in part out of concern of what a large-scale conventional war would look like between Russia and NATO. Now, there are reasons why we might be concerned about that integration, but it also tells us that we have lots of tools in our arsenal to try to prevent states from using nuclear weapons. Another context in which we might be concerned about raising possibilities of nuclear use is in the context of China, which has undergone a rapid development of its nuclear arsenal. China now has about 500 nuclear weapons, and estimates suggest that could get above 1,000 in the next 10 years, and China is building additional delivery capabilities, including a large suite of missile silos throughout the country. These are not just an expansion in the number of weapons that China has, but they have problematic risks associated with them. China's new missile systems are dual use, meaning it would be difficult to tell if a missile had a nuclear or conventional warhead. That raises new possibilities for accidents and miscommunications. And China, although it's long been committed to a policy of no first use, will have a difficult time squaring the investments that it's made in its nuclear architecture with doctrinal promises to try to use nuclear weapons only truly as a last resort. So we might see that China's changing to a strategy that looks something like counter-force coercion, that China is trying to prevent the United States from interfering in its affairs in the Indo-Pacific. And again, this pushes the boundaries of areas in which states might make nuclear threats or consider their use. China might also be learning problematic lessons from the Russo-Ukrainian war. If the lesson that China takes away is that the United States is not willing to use its nuclear deterrent to defend non-treaty allies, that raises questions about what China can get away with in Taiwan. And so we have, in addition to Taiwan, a number of pressing security scenarios with China where nuclear use could potentially be used. Now, I'll mention one other broader downside in the China context, which are questions about strategic stability. One of the areas of Chinese doctrine that experts think has the most potential to evolve has to do with Chinese protection around command and control, the mechanisms that states use to actually use nuclear weapons and communicate with their nuclear forces. China's repeatedly emphasized concerns about what would happen if there were artificial intelligence in the loop or space or cyber-based attacks on those command facilities that would make it hard to maintain control over its arsenal. This could create new incentives for China to act aggressively or maybe even preemptively, although that's thinking a bit further off, and raises broader questions about how nuclear states should manage their nuclear arsenals in a world of emerging technology. There are potential solutions to this. So, for example, the United States and China could develop a more comprehensive missile launch notification regime. They could acknowledge mutual vulnerability or continue to cooperate on AI and cyber, but these are all issues that will take time to resolve. And I'll talk briefly about two other contexts in which I think we should worry about nuclear weapons, aware that I'm taking up a bit too much of my time. One of these is about North Korea, which has also significantly expanded its arsenal, producing opportunities for miscalculation. And North Korea, of course, could take advantage of any crises in the region. If China were to take action over Taiwan, we might expect that North Korea would also have incentives to attack South Korea. And more broadly, we should worry about nuclear proliferation. Of course, the most pressing case here is Iran, which is currently learning lessons about having to have weapons that allow it to deter the United States and its allies and to decouple those allies from each other. Nuclear weapons is one pathway towards doing that. What we see in the Middle East as well is all of the difficulties that come with escalation management and crisis control, problems that would only be made worse if Iran acquired nuclear weapons. And they're not the only country that is considering this pathway. Research that I've done, that others have done, suggests about 72% of the South Korean public want to get nuclear weapons, 87% of the public in Turkey, and experts in Poland and Germany have even considered bringing that back onto the table as well. And so I think what that leaves us with is a world in which there are rising nuclear threats across the globe in the context of a fraying nuclear order. It leaves us new challenges to deal with, including the rise of emerging technology and changes in the perceived role of nuclear weapons.
That is great. Thank you. So the two really interesting takes. I want to follow up when we get to the questions about this issue of compellence that you've raised. But before that, Fred, you've been writing about nuclear weapons since your first book that you turned into a doctoral dissertation, Wizards of Armageddon. Where do you come down on this?
Well, it's worth repeating a story. That in 1960, Daniel Ellsberg, who later became very well known as an anti-war activist and anti-nuclear activist, he went to work at the RAND Corporation. At the time, he was very hawkish. He's a Cold Warrior. Cold War was going on. And he'd done some very classified research into nuclear command control and so forth. RAND Corporation offered a very attractive life insurance policy at the time. And he didn't take it. He was 29 years old. And somebody else about his age also didn't take it. And the reason was that they were convinced they were never going to collect on this. There was going to be a nuclear war. They were probably going to die. So it's a good deal, but why bother? And in fact, I, many years later, in fact, not long before he died, I asked him, you know, in 1960, if you'd consider, what was the chance that nobody in the next 60, 65 years would be using a nuclear weapon in a war? What do you think you would have said the probability of that was? And he said, oh, close to zero. Close to zero, and yet here we are. Nobody has done this. So part of what I want to convey this evening is kind of a modesty. We don't really know whether the chance of nuclear war is greater or lesser. And we might not know until the moment that it happens, if it happens. I mean, so why hasn't anybody used nuclear weapons? Well, I mean, very briefly, I think part of it is deterrence. You know, if you kill us, we'll kill you. That it's a compelling proposition. Part of it is sheer luck. There have been more times than a lot of people realize when American presidents have seriously thought about using nuclear weapons in a crisis. They've actually looked into it very deeply, and they've come away thinking, I'm getting out of this rabbit hole. I'm not going down there. I'm going to solve this crisis diplomatically. And part of it is when accidents happen, you know, computer mishaps or whatever, they usually happen, as you suggested, Peter, when nothing else is going on. So you see the radar is showing 15 ICBMs are coming our way, but you don't really quite believe this because nothing is going on. But the question is, well, what if somebody is the president who doesn't think these things through? Or what if there's a crisis going on and you see 15 ICBMs? But, you know, even then, the answer might not be what you think. For example, during the Trump administration, I was interviewing kind of a mid-senior level guy in the Pentagon who deals with nuclear stuff. And he said to me, he goes, I think there's less of a chance of nuclear war under Trump than there was under Obama. And I said, okay, I'll buy it. What's your reasoning on this? He goes, well, if there's going to be a nuclear war, it's probably going to have something to do with our coming to the defense of allies. And Trump doesn't give a shit about allies. So there's might be something to this. But then there's a flip side of that. And that is, let's say Trump, past or future, makes it very clear that he doesn't give a shit about allies. Some of those allies might say, well, we can't rely on the United States anymore. We've got to start building our own nuclear arsenal. I mean, South Korea is very capable of doing this. Japan is scientifically very capable. Politically and historically, they're a little squeamish about the idea. Brazil, I mean, Saudi Arabia, this could happen pretty quickly. Now, there are some political scientists in the hyper-realist school who think that proliferation is a good thing. Because you have a series of mutual assured destructions, it will deter war. And maybe there's something to that. On the other hand, I go back to this question about technical fallibility. You know, the United States and Russia have decades of built up of kind of patterns, even India and Pakistan, of patterns, of expectations, of fair amount of confidence or at least knowledge of what each other's early warning systems are like. A system of permissive action links that kind of lock up the short range nuclear weapons so crazy colonels can't get a hold of them. Is this definitely going to be true of South Korea, of Saudi Arabia, if Iran gets a hold of these, if North Korea gets a fairly large arsenal? I don't think anybody really knows. And so when you have a situation where, say, two nuclear powers have a matter of minutes of warning time against each, to warn of the other side's missiles coming over, and maybe they don't have a strategic, you know, if there was an attack on American ICBMs even now, you know, the president doesn't, you know, he's got SLBMs, he's got bombers that can take off. Not necessarily true with a brand new nuclear power that just has a bunch of medium range missiles of uncertain reliability and radars that were bought on the cheap or developed on the sly and nobody knows what's going on. So, but then we come back to the question of deterrence, and I'll leave open another proposition here. As I said, deterrence, I mean, you know, you can make a case that it's worked. I mean, has it really worked? If there hadn't been deterrence worked out in a very sophisticated way, would we still not have had a nuclear war since 1960? Maybe. Maybe not. I mean, here's a little bit of history of deterrence, and I'll make this very, very brief. So, you know, early on, the idea was, I mean, it was really mutual. It was, people talk about massive retaliation. It was really massive. I mean, the first nuclear war plan, if the Soviet Union crossed any bit of free world territory, the plan was to launch all of our nuclear weapons, thousands of megatons, killing an estimated 300 million people. That was plan A. There was no plan B. That was it. And so around the late 50s, some people said, you know, besides the moral ridiculousness of this, the insanity, this might not be very credible. I mean, would the Soviets really believe that if they took over West Berlin, that we're going to blow up the whole planet? We need to come up with some more credible nuclear plans to make it. We have to show that we will use nuclear weapons and we're not afraid to do so, but we have to convince them and ourselves that we might really do this. And so over the years, limited nuclear options, selected nuclear options were developed. Technology was changed so you could really just launch a handful of weapons at a time. And so then it becomes kind of an interesting thing. The idea of nuclear deterrence, credible nuclear deterrence, and nuclear war fighting don't become opposites, they become synonymous. You get yourself into a frame of mind that in order to deter, we have to show that we can do this. And to show somebody else that we've got it, that we can do it, we've got to come up with the weapons and the doctrines that enable us to do it. So, you know, we even the notion of deterrence in a more sophisticated formulation sets us up to a position of actually carrying out credible, rational nuclear attack plans if some international crisis compels us to do so. And, you know, even someone like Barack Obama, who looked into the war plans pretty thoroughly, and they had a discussion, two discussions, in fact, within the NSC, whether the United States should adopt a no first use strategy, as policy, as a declared policy. And in these meetings, Obama would say, you know, I don't think any president is really going to use things first. Do you, General? You know, no, absolutely not. But he did not say it publicly because he was told that the Allies would go berserk and they might develop their own nuclear weapons. And so he never said so. And the fact that you don't say so, does this make your deterrent more viable? Because, hey, I might use mine. Or does it make the idea of nuclear war more possible? These are questions that I think theory alone does not answer. And science does not even answer, because the sample size of nuclear crises that we've been through, while larger than a lot of people think, is kind of pathetically small when it comes to being able to formulate hardcore scientific conclusions from.
Well, thanks. That's a terrific set of opening comments. I think I want to pick up on, maybe start with the reference to no first use. Well, actually, Lauren, you referred to it as well. But the story you just told, Fred, about the Obama years, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that the person who was calling for no first use inside the White House was Joe Biden, who pushed for it. And Obama refused to move in that direction. It raises the question of why is it that Biden's now in a position where he could, in fact, adopt no first use, but he hasn't done it. And in fact, there's been, I mean, there's some chatter right now that the Blinken's visit to China, that there's some discussion of no first use and that maybe the U.S. will use this as a kind of opening, a way to get the Chinese to take up some other issues that concern the United States, the confidence-building measures, and so forth. But you're raising, I mean, is the principal concern for the United States here reassuring the allies on
that's
this?
A big, this that's is a what big it, part of it. All, I mean, it's still nuclear, although, you know, unlike 1960, when we really didn't have much in the way of conventional forces. So the Soviets or the Chinese attacked somebody nuclear was really, we do have massive conventional, in fact, superior to what Russia has. But the allies, the idea of extended deterrence, in other words, that the idea of deterrence extends to our allies, they still depend on this a lot, and it's keeping them from going nuclear themselves. And yeah, Biden pressed for it, but, and as I said, there were two NSC meetings. It was discussed quite thoroughly, and the argument that Obama accepted was, you know, first of all, why would anybody believe us? Okay, we say, unless you get rid of all your weapons that have a first strike capability, for example, all of your ICBMs, land-based ICBMs, but nobody's doing that. So why would you be, therefore, why would you want to, if it's deterring, if it's adding to your deterrent, why do you want to get rid of that? Why do, and third, the allies are going to go bananas. You know, when Reagan and Gorbachev were talking about getting rid of all the nuclear weapons at Reykjavik, I'm told the people who went totally apeshit were the Germans. Like, what? What are you doing? You know, Kohl would call up and say, what is going on over there? Are you really thinking about getting rid of all your nuclear weapons? We're gonna... So, yeah, it's still, and there was, you might, when you mentioned Biden, you might be thinking, Biden, 9 days before Trump took office, Biden gave a speech at the Arms Control Association in which he called for no first use, essentially. This speech was written for Obama. Obama did not deliver the speech because there were a lot more urgent things to talk about in his final address, the future of democracy and things like that. He allowed Biden to give the speech. And Biden said in the speech, the president and I believe that the only purpose of nuclear weapons is to deter, which essentially means no first use. But no president has ever said that publicly, and I'd be very surprised if any did.
So I'll build briefly.
Get you both in. Go ahead.
I'll build briefly on Fred's comments here. As I understand it, Obama had a longstanding personal interest in no first use. At least reportedly, part of his now redacted undergraduate thesis even talked about no first use. And so when he became president, there was lots of conversation that the nuclear posture review would change. And the Obama administration brought in outside speakers to talk about no first use. And the reaction was, this is something the US can't consider. And to maybe reiterate why the allies are so concerned about this, if we think about this from the perspective of Germany or Seoul, they're worried about nuclear use, but they're also worried that North Korea sends conventional forces en masse across the border. Yeah. And to deter that, you need the threat of nuclear use. And so the way that American posture is set up, especially when it comes to the allies that we're protecting in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific, they're just as concerned about conventional threats and how to use nuclear weapons to stop them. I think for this reason, it's very unlikely that we could get to a point where no first use is really possible. But there are lots of modifications that could get us closer.
All right, what about, before you jump in, I mean, Macron may like really screw this up, the calculations, right? Because he's basically saying he can't rely on the United States now. I mean, he wants an Iron Dome over Europe. He's offering the French deterrent to the Germans. I don't know how much traction he's really getting there, but the idea, I mean, in a way, it kind of puts the U.S. in a slightly different position, it seems to me. Jeff, anyway.
So we'll just say, and of course, lots of our panelists could talk about this, but the desire for missile defense is not new, but missile defense is imperfect, expensive, inefficient. It doesn't really solve the problem. And France's nuclear posture, despite some of these overtures, really only suggests that France can use nuclear weapons to protect its national interest. And so though there are some efforts to try to fill that gap and say the French nuclear arsenal could protect Europe, but Europe is in France's national interest, the responses that I've seen with, in say, the NATO Nuclear Posture Group are, that's nice, and yet we'll never trust that guarantee because it's not part of French doctrine and it never has been. It would have to be fundamentally rewritten for France to take on that role. And the UK has not made those overtures and has lots of different logistical and political reasons why they wouldn't be able to fill that gap.
Yeah, just quickly, I mean, I think that the recipe for commitments to no first use are, what is your conventional military balance? And if you have a superior conventional military balance, you're more inclined towards no first use. So for example, most of the Cold War, the US was resolutely against no first use because of the imbalance in the central front between the Soviet conventional forces and the US. Today, Putin is gonna be the biggest, and you know why? Gorbachev was great. He wanted zero. Zero would have been a huge win, right, for them, because it would have been like no nuclear weapons in the Red Army in Central Europe. Now, zero wouldn't have looked as good once he pulled back all the troops from Central Europe. Like, that would not have flown internally in the new Russia, like zero nukes. Hold it. Now it's Europe that looks imposing, and we need the nuclear weapons. So any of the situations where our extended allies are conventionally inferior, they're going to be very opposed to no first use.
Yeah, actually, this brings up something interesting, too, that I was recently in Beijing, and I had an opportunity to talk to Professor Li Bin, who is a kind of leading Chinese expert on nuclear weapons, on the negotiating team for the comprehensive test ban. And I told him I'm going to run this panel, I'm going to chair this panel. And so from a Chinese perspective, what's the single greatest risk? And he paused for a second and he said, the belief that these weapons can be used in the context of a conventional war, that this line is getting, you know, is blurring. And I was really struck by it, because Fred, you were talking about the 1950s, this was like a great concern back then, and it's a sense like it's returned, at least from the Chinese perspective. Thoughts about this?
No, definitely. I mean, the last few nuclear posture reviews through all administrations have talked about explicitly the integration of conventional and nuclear conflict. I mean, the tone of it has differed, whether they're talking about it as something that is avidly to be looked forward to, or something that's, you know, oh well, we have to do this to enhance deterrence. But it's, you know, it's there in the doctrine, it's there in the rehearsals, in the exercises. And by the way, in Russia as well. You know, they have this doctrine called escalate to de-escalate.
Yeah.
And their idea, it's the opposite of what the U.S. used to be, which was, we're fighting a war against NATO, we're losing, maybe we throw off a few nuclear weapons, and then NATO says, okay, we've got to stop this before things get out of hand. And in fact, it's that doctrine which in fact motivated the U.S. to start building smaller yield nuclear weapons, like, oh, we need to have low yield nuclear weapons as well so that we can fight back against this instead of surrender. So it's and that was rationalized as, you know, something to enhance deterrence. It can all, you know, you even look at the most war fighting kinds of guys in history, they all talk about it in terms of enhancing deterrence. What will make it less likely that the Russians or the Chinese or whoever actually do this? So, you know, it can all be, we look at it that way, they might look at it in a completely different way, looking at us and us looking at them.
To add maybe an optimistic note on this challenge, So one of the things that I think is potentially beneficial from integrated deterrence is a reconceptualization of nuclear deterrence, not as deterrence with nuclear weapons, but deterrence of nuclear weapons. And one of the things that I think we're seeing is not just thinking about when nuclear weapons might fall into the chain of escalation of conventional conflict, but also a discussion of how conventional weapons can be used to prevent nuclear war. The comments from the Biden administration about how a response to a single Russian nuclear use might be with overwhelming conventional force rather than with nuclear force suggests there might be ways to try to minimize or back down from the use of nuclear weapons that were not previously thought of as part of nuclear deterrence.
That's true.
It's just vexing that each of these issues is a two-edged knife. Of course, the downside of that is that highly accurate conventional weapons might be used to significantly degrade a nuclear force.
Right.
So that countries, in doing their nuclear plans, now have to worry about how many conventional, highly accurate conventional missiles might be targeted at their nuclear forces, thus fueling arms building. So it's a kind of yin and yang.
This is true in missile defense as well.
Right.
I mean, the big argument against AB and anti-ballistic missiles in the late 60s was that, well, this will accelerate an arms race. Because if you have defensive weapons and the other side thinks you can actually shoot them down, well, they'll just build more offensive weapons to overwhelm the defense. But then you take that as a threat and so forth. And listen, I think there's a good case to be made that China has accelerated its nuclear weapons program because, to some extent, they believe our defensive stuff works, which actually really, you know, I mean, we have never tested, talk about strategic defensive weapons, we have never tested any one of them against two Mach warheads coming in.
Okay, so here's a question for you guys. Both of you will know more about this than I do. Israel's defense and U.S. defense of missiles aimed at Israel. What does that show?
Nothing in terms of strategic nuclear defense. In terms of defenses against short-range missiles, even short-range ballistic missiles, startling success. I mean, really a degree of success that could not have been predicted even a few years ago, I think. However, it really has very little application in defending against a large-scale attack of ICBMs traveling at, you know, 11 times speed. Or let's put it this way. I mean, just the fact is, you know, these things are public. Go look at the test results for the Missile Defense Agency. They're not great. It's nothing that you would want to rely on to protect you in a nuclear attack. Whereas, hey, not just tests, but real life of Iron Dome is you know, pretty amazing. If that's all, if you could defend against ICBMs with an Iron Dome, we would be cranking out a lot of them. But
Lauren, you
it's a different technology.
I'll just say, not only is that not what the Iron Dome and these technologies are for, but China is investing and Russia are investing in hypersonic missiles. Mm-hmm. These can evade the missile defenses we have that are strategic. Even if you do look up the numbers that Fred pointed to, those are artificial tests in perfect weather conditions. And when we really start to get into it, missile defense just provides very little value.
So we're going to open it up now. raise your hand. Do we have a mic to go travel around somewhere? There we are. Great. And just introduce yourself and briefly pose your question. So there's a hand in the back. Yeah, right there. We'll start there. I'll group a few of them.
Hello, thank you. Paul Ingram from, I guess at the moment, research affiliate at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge University. Just back from Moscow about a week ago, where I wasn't one of those scientists that you mentioned earlier, but I was at the Moscow Non-Proliferation Conference and was the only Brit, no Americans, very small handful of Europeans. Fascinating conversation about the Russian and Chinese perspective. which of course is a very different perspective to the perspectives we've heard tonight. The US, from their perspective, is and always has been the primary driver of the challenges of nuclear challenges over history. And of course still is, because there is an attempt at strategic dominance and always has been. I think that was mentioned by Jeff early on, this attempt to try to escape from mutually assured destruction. And I think one of the reasons why we're asking this question is tonight is because there is an increasing lack of faith in deterrence from across the whole spectrum of opinion. And that's really dangerous. And that's the dangerous point. It's not so much the technology, although that's part of it, is the increasing lack of faith. And the reaction often is to double down. And that's quite problematic when deterrence assumptions start to fray. So we have phrases like re-establish deterrence. We saw that a week or two ago when the Israelis were thinking about attacking Iran. What that comes back down to is strategic deterrence. So my question,
yes,
I know you're asking.
There we go. Although it's very interesting, but to the question, yeah.
The isolation of Russia as punishment for a sub-strategic offense against the world, is that an effective strategy when it could well lead to a forever war that ends in nuclear war? Are we right to be isolating Russia in almost every strategic international conversation, intergovernmental conversation on nuclear issues and other issues? Or should we be going back to the Cold War strategy of containing the negotiations and rebuilding arms control relations with a country that we find difficult to get on with?
Okay, well, great, thanks. Let's hold on. Let me take another couple questions. Well, gentlemen, right there.
Okay.
You wanna just-
Well, whatever you wanna do.
Yeah, right up here on that. Thank you.
I was interested in the idea of the context of using nukes in a conventional war.
Yes. Hold it closer. Nope. There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Aren't we just dealing with the nature of the nation state? Because the idea of nations, independent nations, goes back to 1789, when the idea of a liberalized independent nations fighting for sovereignty and independence has led to developments in technology, which has led to nuclear weapons. Isn't it just the fact that the technology that has outpaced our ability to live in this modern world?
Okay. And anybody on this side, we have anybody at taker over right there? Yeah.
Hi, so I wanted to ask about...
you are?
Oh, I'm Annabelle Flood. I'm in the LSU Department of Government studying global politics.
Right.
I was wondering what you guys thought about the likelihood of nuclear war, considering the fact that due to the interconnectedness of global economies at this point, nuclear war will lead to mutually assured destruction, not only of life, but also the economic function of the world system. However, that's assuming that the neoliberal world order, specifically global capitalism, will continue to function as anticipated. Yet we're seeing kind of a massive transition of hegemonic power, with many states facing decline in a pretty existential sense. Do you think that this increases the likelihood of nuclear war in general, or not at all?
Okay.
I want to deal with the isolation of Russia.
Okay.
The isolation of Russia is an entirely, entirely a self-inflicted wound on the part of Russia. One of the first things that Biden did when he became president was to renew the New START arms control treaty. It was a meeting that took about 20 minutes. It was a very high priority on his part. He did it within weeks. He met with Putin. He referred to Putin as a worthy competitor. And then, and that was even after they annexed Crimea. After Putin invaded Ukraine, that after just weeks following his statement that he would never do that, following days after his UN ambassador and foreign minister said it was not within their plans, Putin's Russia became an entity that one could not any longer negotiate with. One could no longer trust. Not only that, it's been Russia, not the United States, that has boycotted all of the consultative commissions associated with arms control treaties signed over the last several decades. It is Russia, not the United States, that is in fact withdrawn from allowing any inspectors, which was one of the highlights of the New START treaty, was the really quite intrusive inspection processes that went with that. So I'm one who over the years has written very much against the tendency by some people, especially in American politics, who have wanted to isolate Russia for reasons that are self-destructive. But I see no other interpretation of the events, certainly of the last 2 years, and most of the events of the last 10, that you could put any of this blame on even the most hawkish American politicians.
So I'll briefly respond to the second question here about the pace of technological change. I think part of the danger is not the pace that technology is changing, but qualitative differences in the types of technologies that now raise challenges for us. One of the things that Fred mentioned earlier was about how we're able to come back and detect when there are accidents or miscommunications. And what worries me most in this space is that I'm not confident in the role of artificial intelligence to do this. If we think about the Cuban Missile Crisis, one of the incidents that happens during that missile crisis is someone inserts into, I believe it's that, essentially a tape of a practice episode of a Russian attack, a Soviet attack on the United States. And the only reason why that doesn't escalate is because the officers were able to look at that and say, it looks too real to be true. This looks exactly like what we practiced. But the way that we train artificial intelligence suggests that an artificial intelligence-based system integrated into early warning would do the opposite. It would say this looks exactly like the practice data, and therefore it must be true. And so it's not just about how quickly things change, but the fact that the changes that we're seeing are changes that require us to have a new mindset in how we design and operate technology, and those changes or our ability to adapt to those changes might not catch up.
So maybe I'll just try to address the third question, which I got the link about the decline of nations. I was finding harder to find the connection to capitalism in that. But certainly, you know, declining nations linked to nuclear weapons is not a happy scenario. Many conflicts have started because countries are facing decline, imminent decline, and they believe that if they use their capabilities early rather than late, they can somehow prevent that decline from happening. So that's certainly one scenario that international relations people worry about. I've been doing some research on the link between nuclear weapons and globalization. I think there is actually a plausible link between nuclear weapons and mutual assured destruction and actually the growth of globalization. We talked about the U.S. being a no first use state. The U.S. was able to actually make commitments to countries around the world, which of course then became the basis for trading systems and thick alliance systems. Because of nuclear weapons, after World War II, had there been no nuclear weapons, people wanted the troops to come home. U.S. simply would not have put the money and manpower into those alliances in the way they did because of nuclear weapons. When China was in the late 1970s, it was dealing with threats from the Soviet Union. It was trying to restore its economy. Deng understood that it could not continue to plow money into defenses. defense spending, and it could not continue to have a hostile environment if it was going to renew its economy. It needed to engage with the outside technology, and it needed to spend on civilian industries. And one of the reasons it could do that is because it had nuclear weapons that could prevent the imperialists from once again taking over the country. And a similar story can be told about Gorbachev and the end of the Cold War. So there is a link there between what exists as capitalism today and nuclear weapons.
More questions? Sure. Let's take this gentleman up here in the front. Dana?
Thank you. Dana Allen from the International Institute for Strategic Studies. By my rough calculation, Joe Biden's political career has covered about two-thirds of the nuclear age. And so he's obviously learned some lessons from that. And so I just wonder if I could ask the panel to generally comment on the criticisms he's received by being too cautious and too worried about escalation in the last 2 years, and a nasty word like self-deterring was leveled against him.
This is with respect to Ukraine.
With respect to Ukraine.
Ukraine. Okay. Let's try this right over here, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you. So
hold it up close. Maybe turn it up in the back there. It's hard to hear. Yeah.
Am I audible now?
Now you're on. Go ahead.
So we've had the esteemed panel talk about the effectiveness of the MAD doctrine acting as an effective deterrent to the nuclear threat. But
what
I
doctrine?
Feel like that it's...
What doctrine?
The MAD doctrine, the mutual...
MAD, okay.
Yes. But I feel like that's been assessed in strict confines of... democratic and perhaps dictatorial nations with nuclear capability. But we unfortunately live in a world where we just don't have, well, state actors. We have non-state actors, like terrorist organizations. We have fundamentalist polities, especially in the Indian subcontinent, where we have countries like Pakistan, for example, whose socioeconomic and political condition is deteriorating second by second. So my question is, when we have such entities existing in this world, unfortunately, so isn't the MAD doctrine and alike doctrines essentially, well, redundant? And isn't it just a matter of time before these weapons of mass destruction fall into the wrong hands and everything, well, goes boom?
How about right there? Yes. Woman right in the middle here. Yeah. No, further towards me. Yeah, thank you.
So I'm Hannah. I'm also a student of studying IR here at the LSE.
Just one second. Is there somebody in the audio room? Can you turn it up, like, all the way?
They got to hold the mic
very close.
Like, yeah.
It's hard to hear.
Yeah, so you were already talking a bit about like preemptive wars and kind of holding other powers that were thinking of maybe gaining nuclear arsenals. How unlikely do you think these preemptive wars are? Is it increasing of the risk of kind of
these wars? Did anybody catch it?
You got to hold it right in front of your face.
I think Hannah is asking, and just tell me if this is right, how likely is it that some of the countries we've talked about will actually acquire nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and also like the preemptive war, like what's the, if other states are going to react to that?
Sure, thanks.
Okay, can I?
Go ahead. Go ahead, Frank. Which one do you want?
Oh, I guess I'll deal with Biden, since I've covered him. I guess it depends what part of it you're talking about. I mean, during the Obama administration, after Russia annexed Crimea and went into eastern Ukraine, and there was a debate what to do about this, Biden was the one who was saying most firmly at all, we've got to send in lethal arms, we've got to send back some body bags to Russia. They have to know there's a price to this. Now, at the time, lethal arms meant Javelin anti-tank missiles. Nobody was talking about tanks, ATACMs, F-16s, anything like that. It was Javelin anti-tank missiles. But he, and by the way, just about all the Russia experts on the NSC staff were very much in favor of that. And Obama was the one who, his view, I quote almost directly, was, look, Ukraine means a lot more to them than it does to us. It's part of their history, their culture, their economy. If we start getting into a military thing with them, they're going to match us at every level, plus some. So let's stick with economic sanctions. At the same time, Biden's view of not wanting to tip the balance too much, not wanting to threaten Russia so much that they might use nuclear weapons, for example, I mean, it's kind of the flip side of the same concern. It's that he does understand, maybe excessively, that nuclear deterrence works both ways, that it's not just to deter it's to use conventional weapons can also deter nuclear war, or it can spur nuclear war. So it works both ways. It affects us and it affects the bad guys. So I think both of his views grow out of a long-standing familiarity with largely transatlantic conceptions of foreign and security policy.
So maybe I'll just chime in on the question about non-state actors acquiring nuclear weapons. Definitely a big problem. And fortunately, the panel tonight wasn't about the risk of nuclear use, but nuclear war. So nuclear use, that's a whole nother concern of terrorist groups and radical groups somehow getting hold of a bomb, a dirty bomb, and the consequences of that. But the consequences of that would also be much less than a nuclear war would be. And a nuclear war, which isn't to say I'm not worried about that as well, but the specific scenario you mentioned, a state potentially falling apart that has nuclear weapons, well, could be North Korea, could be Pakistan, although Pakistan has shown, obviously a lot of durability to date. Sense of nationhood is pretty strong, and of course is reinforced by the conflict they're in with India. I think Fred rightly pointed out that even these two relatively new nuclear states actually have quite a bit of history of interaction and how they relate to one another and how they manage this issue. Doesn't mean I'm not worried about it. As you heard, it's the one scenario that I'm most worried about, although the other ones are not far behind. But I do think if I were thinking about a country falling apart with nuclear weapons, it wouldn't necessarily be Pakistan. But that would be a longer discussion about Pakistani politics. So,
Lauren.
So if I can just add one brief comment on non-state actors, and then I'll talk about proliferation. Very few non-state actors have tried to pursue a nuclear capability. Al-Qaeda did have a nuclear program, but they spent a couple of $1,000s and got nowhere. It's difficult to acquire nuclear weapons. So in the absence of state failure, something that I think we're unlikely to see in the modern era, it's not something that particularly keeps me up at night. And there are very few non-state actors that have had other programs for weapons of mass destruction that are much cheaper to acquire. And I think that should give us some hope that these are simply not strategic weapons to use, at least if you're a non-state actor. About proliferation, I'll say one thing about how transitions work. So imagine a state that acquires new nuclear weapons. That state, while they're developing that program, or maybe when they have a very small nuclear program, that's when they're the most vulnerable. And one of the concerns when I talk to colleagues, experts, policymakers in places like Turkey or South Korea or Japan is about what happens if they actually start a nuclear program. Why would China or North Korea or Russia allow these countries to develop the capabilities that would change the balance of power in the region? And there are basically two answers to that. One is because if states proliferate, they might have protection from nuclear allies, from powerful great states like the United States. And in fact, many of the cases that we've seen where countries acquire nuclear weapons, they had some guarantor. Right? North Korea had relationships with Russia and China. The UK and France proliferate with protection from the United States, and so on and so forth. And the other way to do this is to have protection from a large, capable, conventional military. And that's what we see in Iran. There are real concerns that Iran will develop nuclear weapons. Israel and at times officials in the United States have advocated that the solution to that is to outright attack Iranian nuclear facilities. And the US has used subversive tactics like cyber operations. Israel has used assassinations to try to slow down the program. But we don't see large-scale conventional war over the emerging Iranian nuclear program because the costs of fighting a conventional war with Iran are simply too high. The result of this is that states that are considering proliferation have to make a choice. How much is the cost of that program versus the benefits that they would get? And for many states, that simply suggests that there's no way that proliferation is a realistic option. But at the same time, there are lots of countries in the world that have capable conventional militaries or that have guarantor protection that are starting to seriously think about what weapons they need to defend themselves in a world in which the US is not reliable and we're seeing resurgent nuclear threats.
Why don't we take a question down here?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hello, can you hear me? Yes.
Really,
into
very
the
close.
Microphone.
Yeah,
okay.
There we go.
I'm Jackie. I'm a postdoctoral fellow here at the LSE in the Department of Government. And this is kind of biased because I've been researching nuclear policy in the 1950s and 60s, like for the past few weeks. So I'm going to very selfishly ask, to what extent do you guys think that the nuclear sort of landscape of the 1950s and 1960s provides any lessons or anything that we could kind of learn from, or to what extent are the risks similar? Because I was thinking about it, you have new technologies being developed in that day, the risk of proliferation is live, command and control issues abound even within American arsenals, plenty of uncertainty across the globe, issues of assurance and reassurance, some volatile political leaders thrown into the mix there as well, and the infrastructure of the nuclear order does not exist yet at this point in time. So I'm wondering what lessons that could offer us, and then I'm also wondering about the limitations of that. How is today different? Obviously, we talked about that, you know, the United States, NATO, and Russia today are not the same thing as NATO and the Warsaw Pact, you know, in terms of the strategic balance. But I'm also just thinking more broadly, what are the limitations of using the 1950s and the 1960s to draw some lessons or guideposts for analyzing the risks of nuclear war today?
Great question. How about this gentleman in the kind of gray shirt right here?
I am.
Perfect.
I'm James. I'm a master's student here at the LSE in philosophy, actually. And I have a question about sort of war fighting within the nuclear arena. Specifically, like, imagine if you were to see the use of a very low-yield nuclear weapon on the battlefield in Ukraine. Would that require or cause a reaction from the nuclear powers, including the U.S., at a very severe level? Or a heightened state of alarm in reaction to that use of the nuclear weapon? Or is the line between conventional and nuclear war sufficiently blurred in the modern era because of the fact that we have tactical nuclear weapons which are no longer as differentiated from conventional weapons, which can be very destructive in and of themselves, and which those nuclear weapons would not be treated as a significant escalation in a conventional war.
Mm. Good question.
How about all the way in the back, kind of a, it looks like a pink shirt here. I don't, in it.
Hi, my name's Samuel Glover from the Forecasting Research Institute. And I'm interested in, I know from my work that when somebody says something is likely or not very likely, sometimes they're using numbers that the audience perceives differently. So they might be thinking 1%, whereas somebody in the audience is thinking they mean 10%. I was wondering whether you'd be willing to give concrete probabilities of the chance of a nuclear war. So say something like by 2045, what's the probability of a nuclear war that kills over 100,000 people?
This is Chatham House rule here, so I'm teasing. So
I think only a journalist could answer that.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
Well, I'm a journalist, and I'd say anybody who answers that question doesn't know what he's talking about.
How about the other question?
The other question. I'm going to deal with the second question. I want to deal with your question too, but I actually have an interesting story that deals with the second question. And that is that, again, in the Obama administration, and they were thinking about this, could the use of a small nuclear weapon by Russia, could that affect our ability to project power, like in a NATO war? And so they had a little, it wasn't a formal war game, but it was like an informal war game among the NSC staff. And when the deputies met, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, all the deputies, one-star generals, not three- or four-star generals, they started talking about, well, what is the target going to be? Where would we aim this nuclear weapon in response? And then somebody, in fact, well, it's in my book, so it's not secret, is Colin Kahl, who later became the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Biden administration. He was Biden's national security advisor at the time. He said, wait a minute, you guys are kind of missing the point here. If the Russians use a nuclear weapon, we can isolate them from throughout the world. If we were to use a nuke in response, though, we match their lack of... So let's just keep fighting the conventional war. We're winning. Let's just keep doing that. And the deputies committee, that was their recommendation, which was kind of wild. I mean, there have been arguments about whether you should use nuclear weapons first, but not to use them second. But when it got to the principals committee, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, you know, the first reaction was somebody raised the same point. And Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense, just started screaming that this would destroy our credibility, it would destroy NATO. And then they got to the talk of, well, what do we do? And it was, well, maybe we'll fire a weapon at Belarus. In other words, they couldn't come up with any idea of what to do about it. But I'm sure that since Russia invaded Ukraine, this war game has been played at much higher levels with much more serious issues at stake. And I have heard people say that essentially if Russia uses a small nuclear weapon, no, it will not be dismissed as something that's blurring. But what we will probably do, and I think this has actually been tested and rehearsed and so forth, is to essentially destroy every Russian military target in Ukraine and maybe inside Russia, veering toward Ukraine as well. Basically, they would not have an air force anymore. There would not be any military units of any viability in eastern Ukraine. So, no, it has been definitely thought about, and it is an interesting, and we are able to do this with weapons precise enough that are conventional, that wasn't at all true back in the 50s or 60s, for example. So yeah, it's definitely seen as an escalation.
So Fred, I mean, you know, to me, what I'm asking at that point, and I know you've thought about this too, is if they're using a nuclear weapon, they're telling us something else besides, I need this nuclear weapon to stop the military, what's going on, because they've probably got other solutions for that or other ways to address it. What they're saying is, I'm setting this off because whatever comes next could lead to a broader exchange,
right?
So they're laying down a pretty big bet, a pretty big commitment, because they're paying a price for that commitment, which is, I've violated the nuclear threshold. They're going to have to pay a price for that. So if the response is we're going to use all our conventional forces to cause more devastation, it seems to me the message has been lost, and I would find it hard to believe that actually, it would depend on the circumstances, that that actually would be the response.
Well, I think the alternative is, if our response is nuclear, I think the argument is, and I see your point, is that we would then just be legitimizing
right.
the fact that now all wars in the future are going to have a nuclear dimension.
Right.
That we're pulling back on this, but at the same time, we're punishing them to a degree that...
Right. And the October plan, you know, October 22, right, was, you know, from the reports, was going to be a conventional response. But, you know, I guess probably what they were threatening was something different away from the scenario that read it, right? So
yeah.
we're going to target your homes in Moscow, but we're not going to degrade the situation. I don't know what the target
I don't
the
think it was that,
was,
but it was with all that as a backup
right.
of a, hey, you take this any further, we do have this ability to do that
right.
as well.
Right. I mean, I think they were more specific in what they said, but...
Yeah.
1950s?
I'll take a shot at that. I think I've been reading a lot of the similar stuff as well, and I think there's a fundamental difference in what's going on in the thinking between when the Soviets have nuclear weapons and when they don't have them. And as soon as you get, and there's, you know, obviously a lot of discussion, should we use these things? And you know, already there's a certain taboo about these weapons, a certain awfulness. And even as worried as you are about the Soviets, that doesn't mean you're going to go launch a preventive attack that kills millions and millions of innocent civilians. And so one could imagine certain circumstances during that time that may have prompted use, but even with superiority, which over time may have prompted nuclear use, if between you know, World War II and now the U.S. maintained its monopoly. I'm not saying nuclear weapons would never have been used in any circumstance, but certainly MAD fundamentally changed that dynamic, and every situation thereafter was calculated differently.
Can I just say something very quickly? On the one hand, you know, at the time, nukes were, it's about all, it was central. It was central to our deterrence, or to our strategic and security and national. We had no basic conventional power to do anything in Europe. So it was all nukes. That's not true anymore. At the same time, the kinds of, if you go back and as you say you're doing, reading the literature of that time, thinking about what is deterrence, what is a strategic balance, what is the kinds of questions and issues raised are still the ones being discussed today and that still have relevance, although with differences. I think the sophistication of some of the writings, given that it was a brand new thing, is actually pretty startling and hasn't advanced in real sophistication by that much.
Maybe a last comment that I'll point out on this question of the 1950s is that the U.S. understanding of mutually assured destruction, which develops in this time, is separate from how Soviet military doctrine thinks about these questions. So if you look like at David Holloway's book, or you start to look at the Soviet archives, there's a mismatch for a while, and I would argue there's now a mismatch again today, between what these two nations think are appropriate uses for nuclear weapons and how they imagine them. So one of the parallels that I think perhaps we could draw is how do you develop new theories of nuclear weapons when you also have to then communicate those ideas to your adversaries and they have to develop their own doctrines. I think to some degree we're at that point where Russian and Chinese thinking about nuclear weapons is very clearly different than American, British, French doctrine, and we might perhaps move to something that's stable and communicated across borders, but there's more work to be done in that space.
I think we could take a couple more questions. I'll take the gentleman back there with the yellow and white top. Perfect.
So I can see why the cost of preventing proliferation is high. My name is Kevin James from the Systemic Risk Center here at the LLC. But what do you think, how does the panel think about the cost of allowing proliferation?
So, for example,
and the cost of allowing
the cost
what?
Of allowing proliferation. Because we know, I mean, I think everybody agrees that we can't be sure that deterrence is going to be stable at all times, which means that every time an opponent has nuclear weapons, then there's some chance they're going to be used. And that has a very high cost as well. So how do you sort of balance off the, or how do you guys think about balancing off the cost of dealing with proliferation on the cost and allowing it or preventing it?
Right in front there in the red, yeah.
Hello, my name's Griffin. I'm in the Department of International Relations. I'm an undergraduate student. I'm just wondering about the future of sort of competent threats in shaping the sort of level of risk of nuclear war in the future. So Dr. Sukin mentioned the importance of recognizing the increase in Russia's sort of competent threats, trying to defend its advances into Ukraine by using these threats of compelling action. And I'm wondering whether this is a function of the literature. So Matthew Koenig writes this article about sort of analyzing the correlation between nuclear crises and the balance of power between, so like, how many nukes each side have in a nuclear crisis, and he finds that states with more nuclear weapons are more likely to win these crises. Are states starting to recognize this? Are they self-selecting into crises and starting to use nuclear threats in order to sort of gain an advantage over great powers? And are we gonna see this problem increase in the future?
Okay, and one question over here. Way in the back. Yeah, it's you.
Thank you.
You got an assist from the center manager. So, right, okay.
So, hello, my name's Laura, and I'm currently a sixth form student, and I'm here with some of my lovely friends from the same school. So we currently do history as one of our A-levels, so obviously that entails doing the Cold War, so this nuclear war and nuclear weapons and the whole crisis is quite prevalent in our lives for the past couple of months and going on to a couple of years onwards until we're done with our A-levels. So I just wanted to know, how effective are international organizations like the United Nations in promoting non-proliferation and preventing nuclear war? And what more do you think can be done from this angle? Yeah. Oh, and thank you for this amazing opportunity. Yeah, that's it.
Thanks for the question. Excellent. So who wants to start up here?
I'll start with Griffin's question. But first, Laura, I want to say thank you to you and your friends for coming. I think it's important that we have people who are young, that are here, that are continuing to study these questions. And this is true also for the LSE undergraduates. These are questions that are evolving, and as we continue to think about them, it's important to do that from the bottom up. So thanks. Griffin, so there are two components to this threat, one, or to this question here. One is about the future of compellent threats, and the other is about Matthew Koenig's work and questions around nuclear superiority. I think one of the things that is, as I said, quite unusual about Russia's use of nuclear threats is that it's accompanying a new action, right, aggression in the international sphere, and in a way that's quite distinct from how we've seen nuclear threats used in the Cold War. The precedent that I am worried that this might set is for China thinking about Taiwan. And I think the developments that we're seeing in China's nuclear architecture have a lot to do with this question of decoupling or a wedge strategy. How do you develop enough and sufficiently capable nuclear weapons to convince the United States not to defend its allies, right? And that's what Russia has done in Ukraine. Of course, there's another parallel here, which is that Ukraine was not a treaty ally of the United States, and neither is Taiwan. So there might be questions about how useful the strategy actually is in other settings. Nevertheless, this is a very important one. And the other question here is about how many nuclear weapons do you have to have? Does nuclear superiority really matter?
I think from the Chinese perspective, we're seeing an understanding that they have to at least get closer to parity to be able to have more authority in nuclear decision making in their sphere. My own work suggests that in nuclear crises, the number of nuclear weapons you have doesn't give you a particularly strong advantage, and that very small nuclear states are quite powerful. But there's a key caveat to that, which is that they are powerful in deterring direct threats on their own existential interests. And China wants to do more, right? China wants to ensure that it has influence over surrounding territories, and I think is beginning to question what a minimum deterrent that can allow them to do that looks like.
Jeff?
Yeah, so maybe I'll respond to, well, my first question is in back. I'm not gonna answer this question, but do you have a paper you're working on directly right now, our exam question that spurred that question? Because if you did, it's brilliant. It's like amazing research. So, yeah, exactly. Let me just answer that on the cost of allowing proliferation. So, of course, I think Fred referenced there is a particular school out there that believes proliferation is good, because nuclear weapons make states secure, and secure states, may be less likely to do dangerous things. Some of my research suggests that secure states are more likely to take risks in cooperation. They're more willing to cut deals with other countries because they have the security that those deals won't lead to disproportionate gains by the other side, which could then be militarized and brought back against them. So, you know, that's another argument you might say where the costs of proliferation are lower. Now, having said that though, in my mind, the costs of proliferation are still quite significant, mainly because you have a system out there already where what I referred to as the global nuclear order, where use of nuclear weapons is not easy. It's not easy to use these things for other purposes. And therefore, a lot of states have, in essence, the benefits of that umbrella and that opprobrium of nuclear use. When you then think about the cost of proliferation, a lot more states having nuclear weapons, a lot more command and control systems, a lot more situations where you could have inadvertent escalation. It's not clear that payoff makes sense, and certainly from the point of view of countries who control nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, it doesn't look like a desirable deal.
Fred, you're going to get the last word. We're right at the tail end here.
So this issue of numbers and whether that has any impact on deterrence or anything else, you know, right now the United States is embarked on modernization of all three legs of the triad, the land-based ICBMs, the submarines, the bombers, on the idea that, well, they've all become, they're old. They're obsolete. They need to be modernized, and more than that, the Russians are modernizing, the Chinese are modernizing, so we have to do that too. And my view is, let them waste their money like this if they want to. I really don't see why we have to. I think the politics are such, I mean, there was a time, and not that long ago, when people were making not just credible but even politically plausible arguments for substantially reducing our land-based ICBMs. Not, mainly because, you know, not going into the argument in depth, if you want to, I can talk to you later, but that they're inherently destabilizing. They're both the most lethal and the most vulnerable leg of the triad. So let's get rid of them. And if you want to do no first use, what's a way of showing people that you believe in that? Well, we're taking away our weapons that really don't have much more purpose than that. That's not going to happen. No, there isn't going to be any reduction in U.S. nuclear weapons now for political reasons. Just like, you know, the national security budget now is $1 trillion. And that's not coming down. There's nobody who is a serious player in American politics right now, that is saying, as they were saying 6 or 7 years ago, we need to cut the defense budget by 20% or by 50% or whatever. Nobody is saying, nobody who wants to be seen as serious is saying this. I think it's unfortunate, but nobody is saying it. But I do think, look, what I was saying earlier about the complexity of deterrence, that on the one hand, you have to show that you really might use these, and therefore you have to have weapons that actually can do it and doctrines that can do it. I think this is true in the deterrent part of things. If the deterrent goes to hell and you really start getting into one of these things, I think all bets are off. Nobody knows how to do this. Probably things like electromagnetic pulse are going to destroy command control. The idea that you can have, like Herman Kahn said, 38 rungs of escalation or more than one or two back and forths where you're really controlled and you're looking over the chessboard like masters and you're moving here and he's moving. It's not going to happen. And therefore, whether you have ICBMs that are brand new or ICBMs that have been around for 40 years, and hey, if you think they don't work, give it a try. You know, we have B-52s that are literally about as old as I am, and they're working fine. Maybe even better than I am. I don't know. So ICBMs, you know, they've been modified and modernized many times with new warheads, with new software. They look nothing like the ICBMs that they grew out of. So my view is this modernization thing is bullshit, that it has, that you'll be able to deter even without doing it. But, you know, and the sad thing, it's not always tragedy, the sad thing is that Biden once thought this as well. And he had people working on the nuclear posture review at the beginning who were going to say, maybe not quite as extreme as I've said it, but things leaning in that direction. And then, you know, after the Russians started doing more aggressive things, these people got booted. There were people on the Hill and even within the Pentagon who demanded. There was a woman working on the nuclear posture review who was basically just kicked out. And Colin Kahl, who was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, he thought this was a lot of crap, but he couldn't say it anymore. So it has always been a bit of theater, this whole nuclear game, and it's becoming almost nothing but theater. And we can all just hope that it, you know, it doesn't come out to play for real at some point.
Well, normally I like to try to end on a more optimistic note. But I do want to think that I know there were a lot of questions out here. People didn't get a chance to ask your question, but please join me in thanking the panel for doing just such a terrific job covering so much ground.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.